Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the rebooted version of Carl Sagan's TV series from 1980, Cosmos, premiered last night in under an hour. It handily explained the place of our tiny Earth in the universe, which, as the star of the show says, is just one universe in an infinite ocean of universes. My next guest is the star and host of the new Cosmos show. Yes, he's an astrophysicist, and not just any astrophysicist. He's the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History and the author of the book, The Pluto Files, The Rise and Fall of America's Favorite Planet. He's probably America's favorite astrophysicist. Neil deGrasse Tyson, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And listeners, yes, it is time for Ask an Astrophysicist. So anything you want to ask Neil deGrasse Tyson about galaxies near or far, you can give us a call right now, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And I'll start. What do you mean when you say the universe we know is just one in an infinite ocean of universes? I thought universe usually referred to the one big ball of everything while we have tons and tons of galaxies. Am I taking this too literally?
Well, so first, I didn't say that we are one of a multiverse. It's that we may be one of a multiverse. There's good theoretical motivation to think that our universe is but one bubble of some uncountable multitude of other bubbles of universes, each bearing slightly differently expressed laws of physics, which would make it particularly dangerous to visit one of these because our body is held together by certain fundamental forces that if you visit a universe where those laws are slightly different, there is no telling what would happen to your human physiology.
But by definition, could we, because of the universe that we're in, with the laws of physics that we live within, not ever be able to prove the existence of another universe?
Well, we don't know that. So you want to explore. This is a typical dilemma that you confront when you have a cool idea and it somehow at first pass feels sort of intractable experimentally. However, it may be that I'm just making this up, but it's an example. If there could be a universe that is nearby in this hyperdimensional space, and there could be some forces expressed within that universe that leak out of that universe that we then feel. There's an idea, for example, that dark matter, what we call dark matter, is not really matter at all or any kind of exotic matter, but it could be an adjacent universe whose ordinary gravity we feel that has permeated the membranes of the two universes. And here we are touching the side of the elephant, wondering what we're looking at, making up stuff when it's really just ordinary matter in an adjacent universe.
And did you say just a minute ago that there is some evidence that would be tantalizing to scientists that something like that is possible? Is there actually evidence that you can point
to? No, there's no evidence. There are theoretically compelling arguments for why it would exist, and it comes from the marriage of quantum physics, which is the science of the small, with general relativity, which is the science of the large. And the early universe, the large was small, and so you have quantum phenomenon influencing what would otherwise have been a macroscopic presence of the universe. And so in quantum physics, you have fluctuations in the vacuum of space. And if the whole universe is small, one of your fluctuations could then be an entire universe.
So maybe a little closer to home is...
I think everyone should have their mind blown at least once a day.
Absolutely. So, and yeah, we just had it. And we may... Who knows how many times in the next 15 minutes this will happen
again.
That's
all you have? You gave me 15 minutes to tell you about the universe?
You stay longer if you want. I thought that's all the time you had. Bob on Staten Island, you're on WNYC with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Hi.
Hi. This is my question. If you ever see an explosion, like a fireworks, everything, apply it to the Big Bang, everything goes away from each other. It doesn't go towards. So why are we going to merge with the Andromeda Galaxy?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it turns out there in the formation of the universe, if you had a proximity to something that was, you know, relatively nearby, you could become gravitationally bound to it. And when you're gravitationally bound, the expansion of the universe doesn't overcome that. So we and the Andromeda Galaxy are together. We've been together from the beginning, slowly drifting towards one another. As you get farther away from one another in the universe, it's much harder. In fact, it would be impossible to be gravitationally bound given how much mass you have, and then this expansion of the universe overtakes it. So all of the colliding galaxies and merging galaxies, those were all very near one another from the beginning, and they were a lost cause from the start. And if you want to think of that as a lost cause, but anything of any sizable distance, they are moving away no matter what.
Terry at JFK Airport. You're on WNYC. Hello.
So someone does live at the airport.
Great show yesterday.
Oh, thank you.
My question
lives at the airport waiting for the delayed flight.
Yeah, okay.
Terry, go ahead. Sorry.
If we can get particles, protons moving 99.99999, the speed of light in a Large Hadron Collider, what would it take for it to get it to actually move the speed of light?
Yeah, so all of our theoretical understanding of motion and relativity offered to us by Einstein and verified by experiment, that if you take a material object and try to accelerate it, it takes more and more energy to get that incremental extra speed out of it. And so this 99.9999% of the speed of light, we're getting that with really tiny particles where you can put a sizable amount of energy in them and get them that close. But to do that with a human or a car or a spaceship, the level of energy to do that there's nothing we have access to. Now, I know it's fun to be able to say you went the speed of light, but in terms of actually going places, 99% of the speed of light ought to be just fine compared with 99.99999. You're not going to get there that much later. So other than the interest, other than the interest that the physical problem might have, how would you ever travel the speed of light? In terms of practical transportation, there's no real need to have to do that.
Terry, thank you. And so to take our last two calls, the answers to which blew our minds two more times,
okay.
Are there any practical implications, for example, with the merging with the other galaxy? Does that mean we're going to collide with a whole other, you know, collection of planets and suns and stuff?
So you're still disturbed about the collision.
Collisions can be very traumatic.
Well, so there's this galaxy Andromeda, which has, you know, several hundred billion stars, and we live in the Milky Way, several hundred billion stars. We're going to collide, and it's going to be a train wreck. We've seen it in the rest of the universe. You can't wait around to watch it happen because the collision takes several hundred million years. But we have photographic evidence of galaxies in all stages of collision, which was a fascinating revelation coming out of the 1960s and 70s. We had catalogs of galaxies, and those that were in collision were simply described as disturbed or irregular, without really us yet understanding that they're two normal galaxies, full red-blooded galaxies, getting destroyed in an impact. And there's a famous astrophysicist of the day, Gerard Vaucouleurs, who noted that a crashed Lexus is still a Lexus. It just happens to be crashed. So in that state of mind and that understanding, we know what this is going to look like as we go forward.
So by furthering that analogy, the person in the crashed Lexus is probably dead.
Well, okay, so it turns out galaxies, the separation between stars within a galaxy is so vast relative to the size of the star, that the stars within the galaxies will just pass by one another like ships in the night. But what will not pass by one another are the huge gas clouds that are manufacturing stars. The gas clouds are space-filling, and when they hit one another, they will collide and stick like two hot marshmallows. And in the collision zone, you can trigger huge bursts of star formation. And so it'll be a spectacle to watch in the night.
Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson from the Museum of Natural History, the Hayden Planetarium, and the host of the new Cosmos TV series, which premiered last night. And, oh, we have a follow-up. This is probably the show's first ever follow-up question on a statement about the multiverse.
Okay.
But it's Larry in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello. Larry, you there?
Yes, I am. Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question is that in the multiverse and the initial Big Bang prior to that, you have inherently the 11 dimensions of space entrapped in the prior to the Big Bang. And so, you know, in quantum mechanics, you have Bell's theorem of entanglement. And I was wondering if DeGrasse could speak to the fact that it's a possibility that you have all space connected everywhere from the original Big Bang.
Yeah, so entanglement is a fascinating phenomenon in quantum physics where you can have two particles where their state. In quantum mechanics, you speak of not where a particle is specifically, but what properties it has in the state that it's in. And the particle is not only a physical particle, but it's also a wave, and the two waves can become commingled. And we think of that as entanglement. When the moment you become macroscopic, expanding beyond the size of the atom, the entanglement no longer applies. It just doesn't. And the quantum physics, in fact, it's why quantum physics is so foreign to our sensibilities, because there's nothing in our life experience that takes us there. The moment we become macroscopic, then classical, what we call classical laws of physics, become a much more accurate description of what's going on. So it'd be fun to think of entanglement in the early universe, but right now, no, there's no, we're done with that.
Larry, thank you for your call. So the first episode of Cosmos told the story, among other things, of a 16th century Italian monk, Giordano Bruno, who publicly thought that said that he thought the universe was infinite, and he was dismissed and then eventually excommunicated and killed by the Catholic Church. Did you bring that into the show because you see any scary parallels to the scuffles between science and religion today?
Well, so first, the show is written by Andrian and Steve Soder, a colleague of mine up at the museum, and they actually wrote the first two space shows of the newly rebuilt Hayden Planetarium as part of the Rose Center for Earth and Space.
And I hear, by the way, that the current show is absolutely fantastic.
Oh, thank you. We're all very proud of that show. It's Dark Universe. It's called. And it's a celebration, actually, of our ignorance, of not knowing what dark matter or dark energy is. And the great challenge was how to represent that on the dome. How do you portray something that about which you know very little or next to nothing? So, but we can get back to that. But where was I a second ago?
The story of Giordano Bruno.
Oh, yeah, Giordano Bruno. So he was a monk who studied Copernicus, liked the idea that maybe Earth was not in the center of things, that we orbited the sun. And then he took this leap without evidence. He just took a leap and said, if Earth is a planet like the others and the sun is a star like the other stars of the night sky, then maybe the stars of the night sky have planets. And if they have planets, maybe they have Earths. If they have Earths, maybe they have life and people and institutions. And so his God, as he conceived it, was bigger than the God expressed in literally in Scripture or as interpreted by the cardinals of the church of the day. So the issue there is not religion versus non-religion or religion versus science. The issue there is ideas that are different versus dogma. And that can manifest in many ways. You can have political dogma or cultural dogma, social dogma. So because Giordano Bruno was himself religious the whole time. Hmm. He just imagined a bigger God, a God of an infinite universe rather than of one that just focused on Earth.
You see them as compatible today?
See what is compatible?
Religion and anti-dogma views of the universe?
So what you have are, there are about a third of Western American scientists would claim that there is a God to whom they can pray and have that the power of that God intercede with their lives. And they're fully functioning, productive scientists who could pass psychological tests for sanity. So empirically, since you have such people who do science and who are also religious, one can say just based on that, that they can be compatible. More specifically, however, if you start using your scripture, your religious text, as a source of your science, that's where you run into problems. Yeah. And there is no example of someone reading their scripture and saying, I have a prediction about the world that no one knows yet because this gave me insight. Let's go test this prediction and have that prediction turn out to be correct.
In theory, if there is a God, an intelligence that's the source of the universe or multiverses, as the case may be, that entity could have snapped its fingers and created all the laws of physics. not just, you know, put Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden in the traditional way that people think of
it. Well, that's fine, but if you want to now say that all happened in 6 days, that's not consistent with the data. If you want to say that that Earth was created before the sun, which is how Genesis accounts for it, because Earth was dark and you need it. So none of that is consistent with any scientifically derived information about the world. So enlightened religious people know this, and they don't try to use the Bible as a textbook, using a Western example. So the problems come about when this a minority of the religious community who want to say that the Bible is literally true, where they want to go in and change the science curriculum. Then you have issues. There's no tradition of scientists or even atheists knocking down the Sunday school door, telling the preacher what to teach. That's never happened, and it never will happen.
Don in Marlboro. You're on WNYC with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Hi, Don.
Hi, Dr. Tyson. Hello. Quick question. In your work, Doctor, do you see evidence that creation is still in progress? And I mean as postulated by Teilhard de Chardin, the scientist and Jesuit. Quickly, his views was that evolution proceeds from galaxies to solar systems to planets and then to cells of the organic. And now humanity is in the leading end, the leading edge. And that edges into a transformation into a new state of existence beyond the current life, which speaks for a God-centered movement of the entire universe.
And you want to get his reaction to that. Okay, well, did you ever hear that theory before?
No, I've not heard of the fellow, but I can tell you that the way you've posed that question, again, forgive me for not having read the text from which you're deriving it, that it presumes that humans are some pinnacle of the expression of evolution. And I remind you that to detect drugs and bombs, we use dogs for that because we can't sniff it out. There are a lot of things that other animals in the animal kingdom can do that we can't. So for us to think of ourselves as some pinnacle of anything requires a profound level of hubris to assert it. And
in fact, if I could jump in, when astronaut Chris Hadfield was on last year, he said...
Good guy, by the way. Yeah,
great guy. And, you know, fabulous communicator about science, by the way. But he said almost every astronaut, based on their knowledge and experience, believes there must be intelligent life on other planets. Do you agree with that?
Well, you wouldn't have to be an astronaut to have that understanding. You just have to study the problem, and astronauts tend to be well-educated. So it's really the statement of an educated person more than it is the statement of an astronaut. You look out into the universe, and you see how old the universe is. You look at the ingredients that make up life as we know it, and those ingredients are everywhere. And now we know they're rising through thousands of planets in orbit around other stars. So the prospect of life in the universe, especially since on Earth, life formed pretty much as quickly as it possibly could have back after Earth cooled from its formation. And so you say, why would we preclude the possibility of life elsewhere? So now you need enough places with life so that at least one of them would have what we would call intelligent, because most life is not what we would call intelligent. So therefore, most planets, by extrapolation, could have life but not what we think of as intelligent life.
But part of his argument was there are enough planets in the many galaxies that we can surmise have relatively similar atmospheric conditions to Earth. And if we believe that once there's a planet with atmospheric conditions like ours, that it's likely that life somewhat like ours would emerge, then it becomes almost certain. Do you buy it?
No, it's certain for life, for sure. But intelligent life, as we've come to define it, is a little more...
That's more of a stretch.
It's more contingent because, for example, if the asteroid didn't – by the way, I still want to get back to the guy's point about the next state of evolution. But if an asteroid – the asteroid that took out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago, had that not struck, there's no way we'd be here having this conversation because the dinosaurs had been around for hundreds of millions of years before that asteroid. They were around for a longer period of time before the asteroid than the time that has elapsed since the asteroid. So we have no reason to suspect that they wouldn't still be here, and they could be Brian Laird dinosaur having this conversation, looking very different from you. And or maybe they wouldn't achieve what we would call intelligence. Intelligence is not an inevitable byproduct of evolution. if we're the only example of intelligence in the history of life on Earth.
So you wanted to get back to that point about evolution?
Oh, yeah. So, first, I don't see us as some pinnacle of form. That was a common way to think of the tree of life for so long because we came up with the tree of life. So you wouldn't come up with the tree of life and say, yep, we're at the bottom. The worms are at the top. We just wouldn't do that.
People don't usually do that.
Right. Or put elephants at the top because their brains are much larger than ours. We just didn't construct it that way. So to imagine that we are still evolving, the only way you evolve, you don't just evolve because you think there's a next space you could occupy in your brain or in your body. You evolve because there is a selection force operating on you that enables people with some property to propagate while others go away. So you would need some community of truly enlightened people who are enlightened in some way that you're describing to be the only ones who survive something, and no one else can have babies, and they have a lot of babies. And then you have put an evolutionary force, a natural selection force on your organism. And then you can think about evolving. But as long as everyone is having babies with each other, and we have airplanes that connect any two people in the world, the pace of evolution of the human species by natural forces is something that is practically ground to a halt.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, we're already over our scheduled time, but at the risk of testing your goodwill and that of Sotirios Johnson, who's waiting to do the news, we're going to take one more call for you.
Okay.
And I think it's about the Carl Sagan reference on last night's show from Christian in Brooklyn. Christian, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Dr. Tyson, I was a big fan. On the internet a while ago, I saw a response from Dr. Sagan to you inviting you to join him for research. I was wondering if you could talk about your personal connection to Dr. Sagan and if that letter led you to your current state of professional choice, and if you could talk a little bit about that connection. Thank you.
Okay, sure. So you must have missed the show last night because there was a whole section of it where I detailed this, but that's okay. It meant you were probably reading a book.
You spent a day with him. He inscribed a book to you.
Yeah, I was 17 in high school at the Bronx High School of Science. I had applied to colleges, and one of them was Cornell. I had already known since age 9 from a first visit to the Hayden Planetarium that I wanted to study the universe, so my interests were already established. But unknown to me, the admissions officer at Cornell forwarded my application to him at his office to get his reaction. And his reaction was he sent me a personal letter inviting me. And who was I? I was just a kid from the Bronx. And he was already famous. He had been on The Tonight Show and had best-selling books. So that was an extraordinary act of generosity. And I would take him up on that invitation, visit him at Cornell. He showed me the lab, signed a book to me, and one of his books, and drove me back to the bus station. It began to snow. He was concerned I wouldn't get back, wrote his home phone number on a shard of paper, and said, if the bus doesn't get through, call me, spend the night with my family. That's my sort of baptism, if you will, in the universe of Carl. And so I swore if I were ever remotely as famous as he was, that I would have the time, I would carve the time for students in the way he had with me. And so and when I saw Cosmos, I was already in graduate school, the original Cosmos, I realized that one way to communicate was what he was doing, was we had a very fireside manner to him, not I'm professor and you're not. Mm-hmm. And if I would ever was in a position to communicate on that scale, that's what I would do. So that's the whole story right there.
And you are doing it in spades. By the way, I was at the Bronx High School of Science recently and in the science wing, and there was a cartoon.
The whole school is a science wing.
Yeah, that's true. And there was a cartoon posted on the wall that said, when I was your age, Pluto is a planet.
Yeah, and get over it. Yeah.
So Neil,
there's a whole lot was different when I was your age. You know, it was and that's thankfully because it means people are exploring the world and discovering what is new rather than clutching to what is old.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, the host of the new Cosmos series, which premiered last night. 12 more episodes, 12 more Sunday nights. Is that
correct?
The way it goes?
And it's international, 280 countries, 45 languages. So it should have,
awesome.
We expect it to have quite the impact.
And from the planetarium at the Museum of Natural History, and author of The Pluto Files, The Rise and Fall of America's Favorite Planet. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.